On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There's a ceasefire in Lebanon, but a wildfire in Iraq. Weeks after big security announcements by Baghdad and Washington, efforts by U.S. troops and Iraqi forces to stop sectarian violence aren't working. More bomb deaths today in Baghdad, fierce clashes in Mosul and Basra. July was the deadliest month yet in Iraq. This month, U.S. generals warned the country could slip into civil war. Last week, President Bush said that's not happening.
You know, I hear people say, well, civil war this, civil war that. The Iraqi people decided against civil war when they went to the ballot box. And a unity government is working to respond to the will of the people.
This hour on Point, Iraq at the breaking point, and what comes next for U.S. troops and the country. We begin today with the troops on the ground in Iraq for a close-up look at what American soldiers are dealing with over there. Louise Rogue is Baghdad correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Right now, she's embedded with Alaska's 172nd Stryker Brigade Combat Team north of Baghdad. Louise, thanks very much for being with us.
How are you doing?
We're good. Can you tell us what is the Stryker Brigade up to there?
Well, the focus yesterday and in the past 3 days has been on the area known as Shula. It's a Shia neighborhood in northwestern Baghdad, a sort of poor Shia neighborhood. And basically, the objective was to go and conduct a house-to-house search, remove any weapons, basically, the soldiers from the 172nd spent 6 hours clearing something in the order of 400 houses in that neighborhood. At the end of the day, however, they had, it was slim pickings. I believe they found something on the order of four AK-47s during those 6 hours. So clearly, if there were people with weapons in that neighborhood, they were long gone.
Louise, this is the brigade that was scheduled to go home, nearly 4,000 scheduled to go home, and most of them turned back around or kept in Iraq for another maybe 4 months because of this big push in Baghdad. How do the soldiers feel about their current mission?
Well, I'd say morale is sort of surprisingly high and good, considering how close they were to going home. What they're facing here in Baghdad is a very different fight than what they were facing in Mosul. In Mosul, they largely dealt with a Sunni-led insurgency. Here, they have to do a very different operation. They're going to have to contend with elusive militiamen and this sort of very large-scale operation.
The numbers that we see coming out of Baghdad on the death front are just enormous. What has happened since Iraq's unity government, the president announced a security crackdown in Baghdad, and U.S. troops have arrived? Has there been any sign of improvement? We do not see it yet in the death numbers. Has there been any improvement?
Well, on the ground, it certainly looks pretty bleak. Every month, we've had higher numbers of bodies brought to the morgue, just a higher death toll. Also, in the rhetoric, when you speak with ordinary Iraqis, they now say words like civil war. They now talk about partition. Now, 6 months ago, you'd never hear that talking to Iraqis. Now, people who were previously against any kind of partition of the country will now say, well, maybe this is the only solution.
Partition, that is, dividing the country up. And what about the forces who are perpetrating the death in Baghdad? We read that very often they are militia, often tied to politicians, tied to the government itself. So are Iraqi forces helping secure the city, or are they part of the sectarian strife, civil war, if you like?
Well, I had a very interesting conversation with a man named Qad Omar, who's the head of the Iraqi-American Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and he has been kidnapped, rounded up by people he believes were Iraqi security forces, not people posing as such, but soldiers, and had been taken to the house and held there in captivity for 5 days. He'd been beaten alongside other prisoners, and he sort of described a very structured operation there. He described it as a factory, and describing also a sort of dual purpose, as if on one hand, these soldiers were conducting sort of legitimate policing or operations, rounding up suspects, interrogating them, but then at the same time also conducting this criminal enterprise, rounding up regular Iraqis and shaking their families down for money.
So Iraqi forces who are supposed to secure the city, part of the shakedown and the violent angle that is destroying the city. Louise, what about the reception from Iraqis in the streets of Baghdad for American soldiers? How do Iraqis respond to these U.S. troops in uniform in their streets this week?
Well, the response I get, of course, I'm alongside American soldiers, and so how they respond to American soldiers asking about how they feel about their presence might not be the actual how they actually feel about it. But yesterday, people seemed relieved. They said that there was less violence in their neighborhood as a result of this push by the Americans.
So a security effort, and good luck if we can bring some security, and good for the Iraqis in those streets, but the numbers not looking good. Louise Rogue, Baghdad correspondent for the LA Times, embedded with Alaska's 172nd Striker Brigade, which was supposed to go home but is now in Baghdad. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're talking this hour about Iraq, maybe at the breaking point, and what comes next for the country and America's commitment to it. We will return to Baghdad later this hour. Right now, we turn to two of the country's top Iraq watchers with rather different views on the best way ahead. Joining me first from Manchester, Vermont, is Peter Galbraith, former U.S. ambassador to Croatia. He's been in Iraq many times over the years at key turning points for that country. He's been an advisor to the Kurds in the north. Galbraith has long advocated breaking up Iraq and giving the Kurds, Sunnis, and Shia their own countries. His new book is The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. Peter Galbraith, ambassador, thank you for joining us.
Tom, good to be with you.
Also with us from Washington, Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. He has written extensively on U.S. military strategy and Iraq policy. In Sunday's Washington Post, he wrote that the U.S. must now lay down tough conditions for keeping its troops on in Iraq. His new book coming this fall is Hard Politics, The New Politics of National Security. Michael O'Hanlon, welcome back. Good to have you as well.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you and the ambassador.
Michael O'Hanlon, first to you, if you would take the varnish off here, how do you read the circumstances? Where are we, actually? U.S. generals now dancing around with the words civil war, but they clearly have to be politic. Don't be politic. Just name it for us. How do you describe the status of this struggle?
Well, I've resisted using the term civil war up until now, but it's getting awfully close. The reason I resisted it is because even though the level of violence in Iraq certainly in a simple quantitative sense would probably have qualified for civil war long ago, the political leadership was trying at some level to hold together. I think on that specific part of his point that you had earlier on the air, President Bush was correct. I think President Bush went too far to sort of poo-poo the idea that you could even have a civil war or anything like it in Iraq, and it sounded like he was too dismissive of that notion. But he was correct to say, at least, that the top political class in Iraq has mostly been trying to prevent civil war. Now, having said that, many political leaders below that top group are not so bent on preventing civil war. And I think even among the ruling coalition, we're seeing a number of fissures and strain points. And moreover, the level of ethnic cleansing, which was sporadic and sort of, you know, incipient at first, is now becoming more widespread, more systematic. You quoted the fact that July was the most deadly month so far. It's harder and harder to avoid using the term, even if the political leadership is trying to prevent an all-out conflict.
Peter Galbraith, how do you describe it? Is the country at the break point? Is it beyond it?
It has already broken up, and it is in civil war. And frankly, to not see the facts is the reason we don't have a coherent strategy. The president talks about the Iraqi people deciding against civil war and choosing a national unity government. They did no such thing. In the ballot box, they voted not as Iraqis, but 99% of the Kurds for Kurdish nationalist parties, and every Kurd wants independence. There's not one I've ever met in 28 years of dealing with Iraq that wants to be part of Iraq. The Sunnis voted for nationalist parties or religious parties, Sunni religious parties, the Shiites for Shiite religious parties. The National Unity Government, it took 6 months to form. That doesn't indicate a lot of unity. There isn't much of a nation, and it doesn't govern anything. That's the key point. Kurdistan is effectively independent with its own flag and army. Iraqi troops are not even allowed to go there. The Iraqi flag is banned. The South is governed as a theocracy, quite separate from Baghdad. And Baghdad, the government's authority does not extend beyond the Green Zone. And the Sunni areas is a battleground. So what does this government actually govern? Nothing.
Michael O'Hanlon, it has looked like a crisis for a long time. But is it a crisis of a new nature now?
Yes, because since February, we have seen something that Ambassador Galbraith might have said was beginning before, but became painfully evident, that there was a lot of sectarian violence, that there might have been effective political separation prior to that point in many ways. But starting in February with the bombing of the Samarra Mosque and all the violence that ensued, we have seen a fundamentally different character to this war. The insurgency is still there, but it is morphing into and being worsened by an actual incipient civil war. The ambassador, I may be somewhat more or less willing to use the term civil war, but I would agree with him that we are certainly well on the way towards that if we're not already there. The semantic distinction is not really all that valuable anymore.
We're talking this hour about Iraq at the breaking point. At the State Department on Monday, President Bush repeated his belief that the region was at a pivotal moment in history. The people, he said, are determined there to live in peace and freedom.
They have tired of the false promises and grand illusions of radical extremists. They reject the hateful vision of the terrorists, and they dream of a better future for their children and their grandchildren. We're determined to help them achieve that dream.
Okay, but thanks but no thanks, said Syria's President Bashar al-Assad on Tuesday in a defiant and rare public speech. After the ceasefire in the fighting between Israel and Lebanon, Assad says it is the Bush administration and its plan to remake the Middle East that needs a reality check. Here we hear it in translation.
There. Middle East based on submission and humiliation and depriving peoples of rights and their identity has become an illusion.
Battling illusions, Bashar al-Assad went on to say that peace will never come as long as George Bush is in the White House.
This administration adopts the principle of preemptive war, and it is this goes against peace. And a few years after this new administration, it has proved that it does not want peace. So we do not expect peace in the near future.
We're joined by Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, and Ambassador Peter Galbraith, author of the new book, The End of Iraq. Michael O'Hanlon, speak to us about illusion there. President Bush and al-Assad each charging the other with illusion. Behind the political rhetoric, do you have the sense that the United States government, the administration, the military are looking at a clear-sighted way at what's going on, first of all, just in Iraq?
Well, first, I can't help but say that if President Assad wants to help things, he, in addition to rooting for President Bush to be replaced, might voluntarily step down at the same time. He will have served about the same period at that point. Mm. And frankly, he's been a disaster. He's an old-school rejectionist. He's shown no goodwill towards anybody in the region. He's worse than his dad, in my opinion, and I think he's a big part of the problem.
But there was talk of flipping Syria toward the U.S. side, and here he is thumbing his nose in a big way at President Bush and saying, it's your illusion, sir, at work here.
Well, I don't consider Mr. Assad's words to be any indictment of President Bush. They're not serious, in my judgment. There's a more nuanced conversation that has to happen about that, but I'm not going to beat up on President Bush based on what Assad has said. I think Assad has no credibility. Having said that, unfortunately, Mr. Bush's project isn't working. A year and a half ago, he gave what I found an inspirational inaugural address, second inaugural, that was in the tradition of Woodrow Wilson and many other American presidents, and emphasized democracy to some extent, for some people, too much, but nonetheless, in an inspirational way that gave some moral clarity to America's role in the world. And yet all the initial good news that we saw after that inaugural address in Lebanon and in Georgia and in Kyrgyzstan and even momentarily in Iraq and our hopes about the Palestinians, all of that is gone. Every single place we've seen bad news in the last 6 to 12 months. So it's hard to say that the American vision of President Bush is working, even if it is a well-inspired, well-intentioned concept.
But behind that vision, and we understand there are political reasons for him to stick with it, and he's got beliefs here, but do you see the U.S. beginning to or well underway and coming to grips with what's actually going on the ground?
I think commanders in Iraq know that we are in trouble. It's easier and easier to get them to say as much and to admit it. I think that even President Bush is starting to show a little less optimism than he once had, although he can't resist the statements that you aired earlier that, frankly, are a little off-putting and a little out of touch with reality, and I wish he wouldn't make them, because, unfortunately, the critics on this mission are closer to being right at the moment than Mr. Bush. And I think the better part of wisdom is to start from that premise.
Ambassador Galbraith, New York Times columnist Tom Friedman writing today, friends, we are on a losing trajectory in Iraq. He says, unless the party in power for the next 2.5 years shakes free of its denial, we are in really, really big trouble. Where do you see the big illusions here?
Well, I think the important point is that President Bush actually has no intention of winning the war in Iraq. Let's see what it would take to win that war. Winning, I think we can agree, is defined as a reasonably stable, democratic, and unified Iraq. Mm-hmm. To get there, you would have to do two things militarily. You would have to disarm the Shiite militias, which now number well over 100,000, and you would have to end the civil war between Sunnis and Shiites that's being fought in Baghdad and other mixed areas. Doing both of those tasks would require many more troops than we now have in Iraq and exponentially greater casualties, particularly if we were going to try to end the civil war. That's because we can't use Iraqi forces to end the civil war, as the earlier report indicated from the LA Times. They are part of the problem. They are the people who are doing the killings. They are the people who are doing the kidnappings. There are no Iraqi forces that are trusted by both Sunnis and Shiites in Baghdad. So the U.S. would have to become the police of that city. And if you're a policeman, you're much more exposed, much more likely to be attacked. The truth is, the president has no intention of undertaking either of those missions. And incidentally, when they talk about a unified Iraq, it was the U.S. that helped broker the Iraqi constitution, which leaves the central government with almost no power, allows regions to have their own armies, allows regions to control a substantial part of their oil resources. Incidentally, I think this constitution makes a lot of sense. It is one that the Iraqis wanted, but it was something certainly that the United States helped broker. It was also during the U.S. occupation that the Shiite militias grew from a few thousand in April of 2003 to the much larger numbers that exist today, and we did nothing to stop it.
Peter Galbraith, I want to look at the solutions you're putting forward and at Michael O'Hanlon's, both of you with some pretty bold ideas, but we want to understand how our own government is speaking to us first about this. President Bush is often, you know, posed in front of big signs saying victory. You says he has no intention of winning, but that's not how he speaks. So what's going on here? You wrote in The Guardian today that this decision is being put off until after his administration, and that is cowardly. What's the political calculus that you see afoot here?
Look, the President Bush's presidency is defined by Iraq. It's basically the one thing that he's done. And so, of course, to say that it has failed would be to say that he's had a failed presidency, and he can't do it, and Rumsfeld can't do it. But on the other hand, they aren't making the choice either to win, which would involve a huge political cost of sending more troops and actually probably wouldn't work, but at least they could try, or in the alternative to say that, no, this isn't going to work, and then, frankly, to focus on what I think is our one remaining overriding mission which is to prevent al-Qaeda from having a base in the Sunni Arab areas from which it can attack the United States. And aside from that, we could withdraw from Arab Iraq, certainly out of the south and out of Baghdad. We're not going to stop the civil war. Why are we there? We're not dismantling the militias or promoting democracy in the south. Why are we there? And the current strategy for dealing with the Sunni Arab areas isn't working either, because it basically involves using Shiite troops to fight Sunni Arab insurgents in alliance with the U.S. That isn't working. We need a new strategy.
I want to hear new strategies from each of you, Peter Galbraith and Michael O'Hanlon. I want to bring our callers in as well, if I may. First, from Cobb Island, Maryland, Dana is calling. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi. How's it going?
We're all right. What do you know?
Well, I'm on the inside of this, and a year or two ago I wouldn't have even given you my name, but I'll give you the quick story here. Basically, I went in the invasion with as a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the 169 that went in to restart the country under Jay Garner. I worked for him directly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We went into that country, and unfortunately, we don't need a new strategy. We need to use the strategy that we had. There's no country that will take us on militarily. When we went into that country, the opposition evaporated, and we didn't really fight our way in that much.
Well, that's fine, but that's years ago now, and there's opposition all over the place. What do you see now?
Well, what happened was we denied Saddam Hussein capabilities. That's why the Kurds have a nation up north. They built their own government. They built their nation. If we just kept moving into, if we fought a war that said we move in, we don't shoot unless you have a gun, and we give you the ability to live a better life the moment we move in. When we rolled into Baghdad, we got stuck in traffic. The Iraqis talked to us. We stopped. We talked with them. 3 years later, it took me 2 days to get dead off the highway outside our gate after an IED attack.
So we've got almost a civil war. Maybe it is, in fact, going on right now. What's your answer to it, Dana?
Well, the only answer at this point is really the fact that you have to understand it was an illusion. Our ministries were guys with card tables in the palace, and the only ministry that actually worked over there was the banking industry, which did very well. And what we need to do is basically pull our troops out. I mean, I'm military police. I'm also a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be back downtown Baghdad with a bullet in my back.
So pull them out and do what?
Well, they're going to want us out on every street corner playing police to two types of people that hate each other.
Will it work?
So we've got to pull out of the cities, put ourselves in defensible airfields, supply ourselves with air, which is a big event.
So hunker down and let it go. Dana, we hear that. Let me get one more call from Lukman in Boston. Lukman, you're on the air. What do you see?
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And my best regards for Ambassador Galbraith and the other guest. My point is, I think the U.S. is wasting the time and energy and the money in trying to hold a failure state.
Are you from Iraq, Lukman?
I'm from Kurdistan. This is another point. I mean, I'm more proud to say I'm from Kurdistan, but I'm not. I'm ashamed to say I'm from Iraq because I know that Iraq was a failure from the beginning.
Can it be held together now? Can it be held together?
There's no way that it could be held together because the enmity between the Shia and the Sunni is not from today, it's not from last year. It is 1,600 years ago, even before America being discovered.
So you say let it go. We've got it, Lukman. Thanks for your call. Michael O'Hanlon, let me turn to you. You've laid out just a couple of days ago a change of strategy here, not stay the course, but something new, laying down conditions on the Iraqi government if they want U.S. troops to stay there. Why conditions and what conditions?
I wrote this with former Congressman Steve Solars, and we argued that at this point we've had a lot of elections in Iraq. We've had a lot of efforts to give the Iraqis control of their own affairs. As Ambassador Galbraith, I think, convincingly argues, it hasn't been going well. And it's time for them to make fundamental reforms in how they operate if we're going to have any chance of pulling this thing out. Now, he and I may disagree on one of the things I believe that we need to do and that Steve Solars and I advocated, which is to make sure that oil is allocated in a way that's fair to everyone, including the Sunni Arabs. I think right now the Constitution, frankly, is a mess because right now the Kurds and the Shia are interpreting it where they wish to mean that in the future they can keep most of the oil that they sit on top of.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a prescription for depriving the Sunni Arabs of their fair share of Iraqis' wealth and making any civil war inside of the center of Iraq much worse. And by the way, I think we have a major interest in not seeing genocide inside of Iraq, so I would add that to the list of making sure al-Qaeda doesn't come into Iraq that Ambassador Galbraith put on the table.
Genocide. So there's a word beyond civil war, genocide. Do you see that as a risk now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, whether you call it genocide or not, certainly Bosnia-scale ethnic cleansing in a country that's larger than Bosnia and therefore could get into the hundreds of thousands of fatalities very quickly is a real danger.
So rewrite the Constitution so the Sunnis have a chance of some of that oil wealth. You also say make it a condition to keep U.S. troops there that the government or who rein in the Shiite militias.
Yeah, this is the hard part, and it's easier for us to say in an op-ed than for them to do, obviously. And in fact, we didn't even really give a lot of specificity as to how you do it. Part of what we're recognizing is that this is getting to be such a hard job that you better at least try. You've got better ideas on the ground in Baghdad than we can have here in Washington. But one thing is clearly to replace some of the leadership in the Interior Ministry and elsewhere. I don't know if it'll work. I think I'm increasingly persuaded by Ambassador Galbraith's assessment of the situation, although I think we need a much more nuanced strategy for how to manage this, because I think just pulling out would be a huge disaster and that we cannot afford an all-out civil war verging on genocide in Iraq.
But are you serious about these conditions, saying to Baghdad, if you don't do these things, we're pulling U.S. troops out, or are you, you know, is it a straw man? It sounds like that you're afraid to pull the U.S. troops out, even if you want to lay down conditions.
I am. I admit it. There's tension in this argument. And I think if Maliki doesn't do what we propose, I would go to what might be a modified Galbraith plan, although I shouldn't put those words in his mouth. And he's very patiently listening, and I'm sure has some responses. But what I would try to do is think about how we can engineer or help the Iraqis engineer a soft partitioning of their country and some what you might call kinder, gentler ethnic cleansing that does not involve a lot of killing. Help people resettle, help them build and acquire new homes, help them get new jobs, help them relocate in such a way that you can actually do this kind of partitioning of Iraq peaceably. I think that's critically important. So if this plan that Steve Solars and I put forth doesn't work, I would have one more major effort at a different kind of strategy before I would just pull out.
Ambassador Galbraith, here's Michael O'Hanlon. He's been very even-keeled on this war. He's wanted it along the way to work. Now he's saying you've got to lay down conditions. And if that doesn't work, soft partition and softer, gentler ethnic cleansing is the way forward. What do you say?
Well, the problem is, and I read his op-ed, which he wrote with Steve Solars, the problem is that there are not people who want to meet those conditions. You heard Lockman, and his attitude is typical of all Kurds. They don't want Baghdad to succeed. They want out of Iraq. And the Shiites, they aren't going to give up their militias. That's the way in which they exercise control. And the government doesn't have the power to actually meet those conditions.
But there was pride in a unified Iraq at one time, at least among some Iraqis. Can that not be brought back?
There was never for a single day a pride in Iraq among the Kurds, who are 20 to 25% of the population.
Special case, 25%. Yeah.
Well, that's a lot.
It is.
And you can't talk about a unified country if people in a geographically defined area want out of it.
Yeah.
We don't talk a lot about Kurdistan, except perhaps for me, because there aren't a lot of problems there. And the reason there are not a lot of problems there is that it is, in every regards, an independent state, complete with its own army. But I do agree with Michael O'Hanlon about the idea of focusing on a soft partition. Instead of trying to hold the country together, we ought to be working to minimize the civil war. There are territorial disputes between Arabs and Kurds. There are ways to the ethnic cleansing is horrific. It's a terrible thing to have happened, but it has happened. And now one needs to try to deal with the consequences of it.
A soft partition means more ethnic cleansing. It may be softer, gentler, but what you're talking about is huge movements of populations to isolate them one from another geographically.
It's in fact already happened. And it's increasingly happening in Baghdad, where you have now basically purely Shiite and purely Sunni neighborhoods that correspond closely, though not precisely, to the different banks of the Tigris River.
We want to keep the realities of Iraq very much in our mind as we look at these tough choices. Right now, joining us from Baghdad is Scott Johnson, Baghdad Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. Scott, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're hearing about just how tough this is, a kind of an accelerating meltdown there. You've written recently that by any reasonable measure in any other part of the world, this would be called civil war. Is it time to just take the varnish off and call it that straight up, Scott?
Well, I think it is, because I think that's what a lot of Iraqis are doing. Just to give you a broad picture of what's going on, we're in a situation now where Shiites and Sunnis are essentially at war with each other. And the Americans are desperately trying to stop it, which puts them in the middle of the civil war, or at least right on the slopes of it. Baghdad neighborhoods have been completely taken over by militias from east to west, north to south. The militias number in the dozens now. And that's not counting the smaller sort of neighborhood protection committees that have sprung up in smaller neighborhoods all over the place. And the reason they're doing that is because of the lack of any real government security apparatus. And of course, when there is a government security force on the ground, there's also the very real possibility that those forces are going to be infiltrated by militia members or people sympathetic to their cause, which is a source of endless anxiety and frustration for Iraqis.
Scott, let me ask you, if I may. Washington said just a few weeks ago, we're going to fix this. We're going to pour U.S. troops into Baghdad and stop this, fix this. Is it working?
Well, the security plan that they outlined just began a few days ago, and what they're hoping to do is sweep through the city, particularly emphasizing those neighborhoods where which they're calling the fault line neighborhoods, where Sunnis and Shias have had higher levels of violence. And so they're going through house to house, street to street, and finding, in some cases, for instance, in Ghazaliya, where one of my colleagues is now, that people in those neighborhoods have not left their homes for weeks, literally, because they're so fearful of the Shiite militias, which have made incursions into their neighborhoods, setting up checkpoints, executing people on site for having the wrong IDs, for instance.
But can this be turned around? Is there hope of seeing it turned around there? Or is this just a holding pattern to keep Baghdad from completely melting down?
Well, I think the consensus here is that it is sort of a holding pattern, because what we've seen in the past is that when operations like this have taken place, they have resulted in short-term changes, a brief end to the violence, perhaps some initial recovery, but then because of the paucity of U.S. troops on the ground and because of their inability to stay long-term and protect those areas, often those neighborhoods simply revert to insurgent control or militia control as the troops move elsewhere to deal with other problems.
Scott Johnson, Baghdad Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. Scott, thank you very much for joining us. Be safe there.
Thank you.
Let me turn to some tape here from Senator John Warner, chair of the Armed Services Committee, pressing General Peter Pace, who appeared chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He was before the committee just, 10 days ago, asking him to define the role of U.S. troops in Iraq if indeed it all melts down.
What is the mission of the United States today if, under this resolution, if that situation erupts into a civil war, what are the missions of our forces?
Sir, I believe that U.S. Armed Forces today can continue to do what we're doing, which is to help provide enough security inside of Iraq for the Iraqi government.
General Peter Pace, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Michael O'Hanlon, do you agree with that? Do you believe that U.S. forces today can continue to provide enough security for the Iraqi government, whatever that means?
Whatever that means is the right point, Tom. I think that most of the Iraqi government officials are not being assassinated, although a lot of lower-level officials are. Most of the Iraqi professional class is in fear of its life or of being kidnapped. So if you define the government and the ruling elite very narrowly, then perhaps General Pace is literally correct. But obviously, we're not succeeding. I mean, it's pretty hard to claim that we're bringing any level of stability to Iraq. And on balance, 6 to 12 months ago, I would have said the mission was treading water. Now I would have said it's beginning to fail. And so I'm moving into the Galbraith camp, even if not fully there yet. But I don't see how you can read General Pace's comment as anything but essentially a very, very feeble effort to claim some limited success in the face of an overriding, ongoing, deteriorating situation.
Let me ask you, you've been a very sober analyst here, Peter Galbraith, a very keen analyst. Ambassador Galbraith says the Bush administration is cowardly if it doesn't face up to what's going on and address it before they get out of office. Do you see that change in thinking going on? Are they facing up to what's there and being honest, or do you see a political obfuscation underway?
Well, you know, I don't think we should expect a president who, as Ambassador Galbraith said, has hinged his whole legacy on Iraq to be the most neutral observer on this issue.
Yeah, but we expect him to lead the country and not lead another country and ours into disaster, if that's what I mean. He does have responsibilities that are beyond political here, does he not?
Well, I'm not defending his overall performance, but I'm simply saying you would not expect him to be the guy who is emphasizing in his daily press briefings how badly things are going in Iraq. You would expect him to be the guy looking for some kind of positive signs to build upon, as long as he's doing so in a partially or plausibly realistic way. And I think that's the key point that's changing. I think in the last few months, we've seen the case for optimism, any reasonable case for optimism, dissipate very fast. And we're getting now to crunch time. We're on the verge of failure. And I think the president's going to have to begin to speak that way if he wants to be in touch with reality or the American people.
Ambassador Galbraith, do you see signs that the Bush administration is facing up to the reality and dealing with it in a material way?
None whatsoever. And that is the problem when you deny the facts on the ground, when you pretend, as Tony Snow did today, that there's a strong Iraqi identity and that these ethnic identities are essentially unimportant. it happens when you deny that there's a civil war. And I'd say that it's cowardly. I think it is cowardly to keep U.S. troops tied down to a mission that is clearly will not prevail. So we should have a choice. Either we should apply the resources to accomplish the mission, which means many more troops, or in the alternative, have a mission that matches the resources that we're prepared to apply.
Is that a real choice? Do we have those troops and those more hundreds of billions to take option A?
No. At least it's a theoretical choice, but that we have a goal that cannot be accomplished with the resources that the president's prepared to commit and the country's prepared to support. But if you're not going to do that, and clearly we are not, that's why I say he has no intention of winning, then we need to change the mission. And if we're not going to promote democracy in the South, if we're not going to dismantle theocracy, if we're not going to take on the militias, we have no reason to be in the South, neither we nor the British. Again, if we're not going to stop the Civil War, and frankly, as Scott Johnson described it, these sweeps are doing very little. I suppose they provide some temporary comfort, but they don't solve the problem in Baghdad. We shouldn't be there. It's a terrible situation. And perhaps in an ideal world, we should try to stop the Civil War, but we're not going to do it. So I would say get out of there. And then again, we need a different strategy to take on the Sunni insurgency.
It makes the talk of staying the course just seem mind-blowing wherever you come at this war from. Let me take a call from Fort Dodge, Iowa. Mike's on the line. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think, Mike?
I got a comment. I think the Bush being reluctant to say it's a Civil War is a simple fact. He'd have to go back before Congress to get any money, more money, to keep going, wouldn't he?
And maybe new permissions, as Senator John Warner suggested in that same testimony. Yes, so what does that leave you seeing?
I just think it's time to get our stuff together and either get out or do something different, because it ain't working what we're doing.
So let's reconnoiter here. Mike, thanks for your call from Fort Dodge. From Rockville, Maryland, Steve is calling. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I would respectfully differ with my good friend Peter on his analysis. Number one, I don't think we're dealing with a civil war. I think we're dealing with a proxy war.
And the proxies in this one? We're out of Lebanon now and in Iraq.
Iran is a proxy and as being a financial supporter of Shia groups. The recent statements, the joint statements by, or at least coordinated statements by Assad and Iran show, to me, a very peculiar alliance between Sunni Baathists on the one side and Shia on the other, which looks to me to be a marriage of convenience.
Let me ask you then, you're saying that if Iran would back off, we'd have a love fest in Iraq?
No, what I'm saying is that all of the analysis, again, in all due deference, is a little bit too simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, number one, the concept of Iraq as a geographical region is a reality over the last 40 or 50 years. But to make the suggestion that there is no basis for holding this together would also suggest that Pakistan has no reason for staying together because the Northwest Territories have no allegiance to a central
government. But, Steve, are you saying then that we can, put the heat on Tehran and settle everything?
Here's what I'm saying to you in my terms. What I'm saying is that, in fact, what goes on in Iraq is extraordinarily important to the United States and to Western civilization, because it's intertwined in a much larger fight. And people who have failed to recognize that and admit it, probably for political purposes, are doing Americans a disservice.
Steve, hang on. I want to put that to my guests. And I see here in my notes, you're a former deputy counsel on the House International Relations Committee.
That's correct.
Peter Galbraith, there's a challenge that says this isn't civil war, this is proxy war, and we have to fight it, whatever you may think.
Look, I agree that Iran is very much involved in this. It created the largest Shiite party and has funded the militias. Incidentally, the name of that party, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, gives you a clue as to its agenda.
Mm.
But the Bush administration, Paul Wolfowitz, argued that, in fact, Iraq Shias would all be Western-oriented and democratic and undermine Iran. And, of course, curiously enough, that hasn't happened. the issue that Steve has to answer is what are we going to do about it? Are we going to take on the Shiite militias? Are we going to fight a war against an army supported by Iran that now numbers 100,000? Which isn't going to happen. And part of my argument actually for – I don't advocate the partition of Iraq. I simply say let's face up to the reality that it's happened. If you had a unified Iraq, you would have Iran that is dominant over all of Iraq. That is a consequence of what Bush has done.
If
you have a division of it, at least it dominates only the southern half of the country.
I'll put that question of what we do then to Steve. But on your side of the hook, he's saying, look, we can't afford to lose here because this is a global contest. Iraq is a major battleground.
It's at least a regional.
Ambassador Galbraith, what do you say to that? If I may go to Peter Galbraith first here, Ambassador.
Well, look, what I've laid out is a choice. Are we prepared to do what is required to win, which is to deploy perhaps 300,000 or 400,000 troops and to take 10 times as many casualties because we're going to take on the Shiite militias and take on the and try to end the civil war? I don't think that the administration has the slightest intention of doing that. It is simply locked into a losing course of action. And rather than stick with a losing course of action, I would say we ought to accept the reality and, again, get out of the South, get out of Baghdad, and have a different strategy for the Sunni areas.
Steve, what do you say to that? Are you ready to see 300,000 troops go in there, 10 times the casualties?
Well, if I may respond to it, Peter, I think the analogy that is quite appropriate here is then we have to ask the same question of whether the ceasefire recently negotiated by the United Nations Security Council between Lebanon and Israel, where Hezbollah is the real party of interest, without having Lebanese forces being willing to accept their responsibility of controlling Hezbollah within their territorial limits, and without the world community being willing to put up the resources, is exactly the same parallel that you're talking about.
Steve, we've got the perspective. I want to put it to Michael O'Hanlon. Mr. O'Hanlon, what about it? The suggestion, there's a regional mega fight on here, and whatever the details, we can't afford to lose or be seen to lose in Iraq. We have to hang in.
Well, it would be nice to win, but I don't know that we have a very practical way to get there. And I think anybody who's advocating winning has to say how we're going to do something differently. I've got a few ideas along with those of Steve Solars and other things I've been pushing for a stronger economic strategy. And I think, frankly, a jobs program would help us with one of the things that is needed here, which is to help people resettle peacefully if they feel so much in danger they can't stay in their old neighborhoods. Whether there has to be a big national policy for relocation or more something you give individuals the opportunity to do.
So this is your soft ethnic cleansing, sort of move to a Sunni or all Shia or all Kurd area and we'll have a job for you.
If you want, yeah. And I think that's not just a response to the looming civil war. It's also a response, frankly, to the insurgency, which has continued to feed off of unemployed, angry, young Sunni Arab men for 3 years. I would also say one quick thing on behalf of the Shia in Iraq, which is that for 2.5 years they showed a lot of restraint for the most part. And the Sunni Arabs continued to attack all the levers and institutions of government, which were primarily populated by Shia because they're the majority. And so as much as Iran has tried to foment this and encourage the violence, for a long time the Iraqi Shia had a different agenda from Iran and tried to make it work, and they ran out of patience. And at some point, therefore, I wouldn't view this strictly as a proxy war. I think it's the Shia running out of patience and saying, enough's enough, we're going to retaliate for our own reasons, irrespective of what Iran wants. Now, yes, there is some collusion. Yes, there is incitement. And yes, the Iranians have shipped IED technology in the way of these roadside bombs into Iraq. But I think the war is closer to what Ambassador Galbraith has been describing than to Steve's version of it, in my opinion.
Well, we're getting closer to something like reality here, and it looks very different from what we're hearing officially. Peter Galbraith, do you hear the conversation shifting in such a way that we can begin to realistically get at grips with this conflict in just the few seconds we have here?
Well, the fact is that the Bush administration has acknowledged the breakup of Iraq in its actions. It's not doing any of the things that might put the country together. And, in fact, Ambassador Khalilzad helped broker the deal that gives the regions all the power. So it's a small additional step to forming a Shiite region, to forming a Sunni region with their own armies and being able to provide security.
It's eye-opening, it's scary, but it's better to see things, I guess, as they are. Ambassador Peter Galbraith joining us today from Manchester, Vermont. The new book is The End of Iraq. Ambassador Galbraith, thank you for being here.
Tom, good being with you.
And Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution, forthcoming book, Hard Politics. Mr. O'Hanlon, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.